Erev Tov. We'd like to welcome everybody here to Machon Pardes, and we're delighted to be inaugurating another annual lecture series, the Hirschdorfer Kantrowitz Brettler Lecture Series of this year. First of all, I'd like to make an apology about the elevator. We had the fix-it guy here until about an hour ago. We were praying, hoping. The only thing we can maybe console you with is two things. The rabbis talk about the reward of learning, but also schar halicha. And I think everybody got schar halicha today. And if that doesn't do it for you, then you can just, you know, be glad for the exercise. And if you want, you can pay your gym membership to Machon Pardes, and we'll let you walk the stairs all day for free. Okay. All right, we will turn off the fans. Then we're going to have people say it's too cold when we have the air conditioning and too hot. I know, been there. We're going to try and make it comfortable, but it might not be perfect, but we will turn off the fans. Second important announcement is that after the lecture, the shiur, there will be arvit, there will be mariv. It will take place down the hall in room 3. In room 3, just a couple of minutes after the room clears, so you can rest easy. There will be mariv afterwards. The third thing I just wanted to draw your attention to is these flyers which are on the seats. They announce a new season of community education classes here at Pardes. We're delighted that the program is growing from season to season, and we've just started a new program this week, a new series of shiurim which contain both Tanakh and Torah Shebaal Peh, classes on Talmudic personalities, Israeli literature, and a wonderful Tour with Text series, which is being taught by Dr. David Bernstein on great modern Zionist thinkers, starting this coming Thursday with tours by Shuli Mishkin. If you just probably turn around in the room, you'll see many very happy participants to the program, and you're welcome to come and try it out. Just turn up, come, try a class, and we hope you will join us as well. Okay? Oh, right. Tomorrow's classes, for anybody who's worried that they won't be able to get up the stairs, we're going to make them on the ground floor so that people won't have to endure the trek. But the classes you see here listed, David Levenkross, What's Above and What's Ahead, God and the Afterlife, will be taking place tomorrow morning at 9, and Great Modern Zionist Thinkers at 11, so you're welcome back tomorrow. I'm going to now hand over to Rabbi Daniel Landes.
I have the rabbis love this elevator thing breaking down because there's so many drushes, you know. But I'll forego it. I have the pleasure, but now it's only a partial pleasure, of thanking the Brettler family for making this lecture possible. I hope next week Sid will be able to be with us and we can thank again. But what I can say, because he always refuses everything, you know, to accept the acknowledgement. But it was his idea. It wasn't that we pitched the idea to him. He pitched the idea to us. And he pitched it a couple of times until we got the message. And thank God, it's been a wonderful series. So I'd like to invite, it's been a family endeavor, so I'd like to invite Dina or Dan, his daughter, to speak and to give us an introduction to the speaker.
It gives me great pleasure to represent the Brettler family at the opening of the 4th annual Hirschdorfer Kantrowitz Brettler Lecture Series at the Pardes Institute. If I had to choose a characteristic of our family that makes the Pardes Institute a most suitable venue for this series, it would be intellectual curiosity. Open discussion and penetrating questions on all aspects of Judaism were always part of our family life, and I believe this is a feature shared and promoted by the Pardes Institute as well. To date, this stimulating, thought-provoking series has been devoted to different aspects of the Bible. The topic, Megillat Ruth, is certainly appropriate as we count the days from Passover to Shavuot. I am very pleased that our speaker for the series is Dr. Yael Ziegler. I regret that I am not well acquainted with Dr. Ziegler, although I do have a nodding acquaintance with her from the National Library, from the Judaica Reading Room, from the days when she was writing her doctoral dissertation. Dr. Ziegler is currently a lecturer in Tanakh at Herzog College and Matan. Awarded her PhD in Tanakh by Bar-Ilan University, she is the author of Promises to Keep, The Oath in Biblical Narrative. She has been a guest scholar at synagogues and schools throughout the United States, Israel, and Europe. Last summer, she also delivered a very popular series of lectures on Megillat Echad Pardes. I am looking forward to hearing her insights on Megillat Rut. On a personal note, I'd like to say that I'm especially looking forward to the third lecture in the series. I've always wondered what exactly happened on the threshing floor that night. Thank you.
Erev Tov, Chodesh Tov. It's wonderful to be back here at Pardes and to see so many familiar faces and so many new faces as well. I thank Pardes and Alex, Israel especially, for inviting me to speak, and the Brettler family for sponsoring this lecture series. I'm very much looking forward to learning the book of Megillat Rut together with you in the next few lectures. Megillat Rut may be a short story, but it is a masterful literary piece, and this is one of the things that I want to show you. Its content may seem sometimes somewhat humdrum in its nice narrative of one nice Judean family in Beit Lechem during the period of the Judges, but I believe that this book is a theological linchpin in the Tanakh. It is a watershed narrative which facilitates the monarchy, and it sets out to create and to construct an ideal social infrastructure for the nation of Israel. Although Megillat Rut is a very well-known story, and my assumption here is that most of you are very familiar with the four short chapters of this very idyllic narrative, it seems to be a fairly simple story. During the course of our series, I hope that we will encounter Megillat Rut in a new and stimulating way, and I'll be able to offer some fresh ideas to this very familiar book. I'd like to use this opportunity of this series to view Megillat Rut from several different perspectives. I want to use an intertextual perspective in which we view Megillat Rut within the larger corpus of Tanakh. I want to use a literary structural perspective in which we look at the internal structure of the book, we look at the literary techniques of the book in order to discern its theological underpinnings. We're not just engaged in a quest for aesthetics. We're also, and perhaps primarily, engaged in using aesthetics in order to find the deeper meanings, in order to understand the theology which accompanies this book and which leads this book to its triumphant conclusion. It's not my intention to review the book of Rut. My assumption is that most of you know the book. If you don't, if you're not very familiar with the book today, we're going to be doing mostly a review of Rut within the context of the book of Judges. And so I recommend for those people who are not very familiar with the book to read it in preparation for the next class. In the next class, we will be already beginning with the real text of Megillat Rut. It's just four short chapters, and it's really very readable. Instead of really just learning the book, I want to examine the themes that underlie the book. I want to understand what accounts for this book's singularity. And of course, this is one of 24. Only 24 books make it into Tanakh. And there are many other books that don't make it into Tanakh. And if this book made it into Tanakh, it means that it doesn't have just a nice little story. It means that the story is of profound historical, theological significance for the Jewish people. In today's class, as I mentioned before, I want to examine the historical context of this book, and I think that this is absolutely essential for understanding the goals of the narrative. One of the things that I'm going to try to do is pull together all four classes. As many of the things that we'll be talking about in today's class are going to come up again in the next class and in the class following that, and at the end, in the final class, I want to try to pull together some of the themes that I'm going to build up during the course of this series. Immediately when we encounter Megillat Rut, we understand that it has a broader historical context. Because Megillat Rut starts with the words, Vayhi bimei shvot ha-shoftim. And it was in the days of the judging of the judges. Now this historical context is a very well-known context because we have the book of Judges. We don't have to guess what's going on during the period of Megillat Rut. Not only that, but as soon as we encounter the Megillah, what we're being told is you have to read this Megillah within its historical context. You can't read it without a historical context. The book of Judges is a book which is much longer than the book of Megillat Rut. It's much richer. It has 21 chapters of mostly narrative, mostly very interesting narrative, oftentimes rather violent narrative, some of which we'll be talking about today. And the book of Judges, of course, details the interim period between two very good periods, right? We have the period of the conquest of the land, which is, of course, the book of Joshua, and that comes before Sefer Shoftim, before the book of Judges, and the book following the book of Judges is the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel, which is the book of the setting up of the monarchy. Now, between those two periods, we have the period of the Judges, and by explicitly placing Megillat Rut within the context of the period of the Judges, the verse itself forces us to ask certain questions. Number one, why isn't this little book part of the book of Judges, right? If it takes place during the period of the Judges, the book of Rut is only four short chapters. It could easily be slipped in between maybe Devorah and Gideon, or between Gideon and Yiftach. It could just be slipped in wherever actually it takes place historically. And yet it is not, right? It appears here as a separate book. This leads me to my next question. Can we identify precisely when Megillat Rut takes place? And really, I mean, the question is also a question about the formulation of this opening pasuk. Why didn't the book of Rut open it much more simply? Vayhi bimei Dvorah, right? Vayhi bimei hashofet Gideon. It was in the days of a specific person. The book of Judges is approximately, and there's some argument about this, around a 300-year period, right? So by placing Megillat Rut in this very, very broad historical period, it a little bit raises the question of when Megillat Rut specifically took place and why we're not told specifically when it took place. That's a second question. And perhaps the most significant question of all is, in what way the historical context is important for understanding the Book of Rut? And this is very especially important in light of what I said previously, and that is that on some level, when we first encounter Megillat Rut, we are struck by its, dare I say, insignificance, right? Certainly on a national level, right? We meet this book, it's a nice family, it's the family of Naomi. They left the country and then they come back and they have all sorts of troubles because, of course, you know, the father died and the sons died and there's a threat of lack of continuity to the family, and eventually everything's resolved and Naomi is in a much better situation than she was in the beginning of the book. And that's the whole story. But the story seems to lack national significance, right? It's not, for example, Megillat Esther, where the threat of genocide hovers over the Jewish nation, right? And so I want to understand if, by placing Rut in a broader historical context, if I can arrive at perhaps a deeper significance for the book and try to understand perhaps some of the national significance for the book. Now, in order to do this, I want to begin by doing something fairly ambitious, but in my view, utterly necessary for understanding the book of Rut, and that is outlining the book of Judges in summary, okay, which is a difficult thing to do. It's 21 chapters. In order to help you do this, I did on page one outline the book, at least in terms of the major judges. If you see here, I skipped over the minor judges, the ones that we don't have very many stories, and I just brought here the major judges just to give you a sense of the trajectory of the book. Now, perhaps the most basic summary that I could make, and I think it's pretty obvious from the title of tonight's lecture, is that the book of Judges records a terrible period in Jewish history. It's a terrible period. It is a period of sins. It is a period of war, both external and internal wars. We have a series of civil wars, and of course we end with civil war. It is therefore, of course, a period of social fracture. It is a period of increasingly inadequate leadership. More troubling, this period depicts an era which is not static, but which is in a state of decline throughout the book. All of the different problematic situations which I've just noted, religious, social, military, leadership, they all get progressively more problematic throughout the book. And so we're in this sort of downward spiral during the period of the judges, and we're going to see that the period of the judges ends with a cataclysmic, horrific story, which really leaves Am Yisrael, the nation of Israel, hovering over this abyss. There's a threat of destruction which looms over the nation of Israel at the end of the book of Judges, and that's the short summary of the book of Judges. The end of the book, of course, portrays the hopeless situation of what I called here murder, mayhem, and civil war. That's where the book is going. And what I want to do a little bit is describe in a condensed form, maybe just sort of skimming over the book of Judges, just to get a sense really of the way in which things decline in each of the major areas of interest in the book. I'm going to talk about three major areas: religious, social, and leadership. The religious decline is fairly well known. The book of Judges begins in chapter 1 by telling us that the nation of Israel failed to uproot the idolatrous Canaanites from the land. Indeed, Joshua in the previous era had succeeded largely in conquering the land. Most of the Canaanites were subdued, but there were still pockets of Canaanites left in the land. And in the book of Judges, the first thing we're told in the book is that the nation of Israel left them there, right? They said, okay, you know, we'll live alongside of them. And the results are catastrophic because the nations, the Canaanite nation, continues to live alongside the nation of Israel. The idolatrous Canaanite culture begins to penetrate into the society in Eretz Israel, into Am Yisrael. This is the Torah had already predicted. We see it over and over in the Torah. In Shemot, we're told that this is going to happen. In Bamidbar, we're told this is going to happen. In Devarim, we're told this is going to happen. And of course, the nation of Israel is nothing if not obstinate. And of course, they do not listen to all of these warnings of the Torah. And as the book progresses, idolatrous practices become the norm. And the relationship between God and his people begins to deteriorate and even becomes threatened. Now, nearly every story in the book begins with the words, Vayasu b'nei Yisrael hara b'nei Hashem. Am Yisrael did what was evil in the eyes of God. And we see that the idolatry seems to get worse and worse as the story progresses. So then in the story of Gideon, he makes a golden ephod, right? Very reminiscent of the golden calf. And everybody starts worshiping it. Well, the story, so the religious decline of the nation of Israel comes to a head, actually not at the end of the book, but actually in chapter 10, which is right smack in the middle. We're talking about a 21-chapter book. I want you to look, please, at this source that I brought for you here in source number 2. Here we have probably the least interesting chapter in the book of Judges because it's a chapter that doesn't have a narrative. Instead of a narrative, it records this very long description of the idolatry that has accumulated and that the people are worshiping in the land of Israel during or right smack in the middle of this period of the Judges. Let's look here in chapter 10, verses 6 through 14. Vayosifu bnei Yisrael lasot hara b'inei Adonai, vayavdu et ha-ba'alim ve'et ha-shtarot, ve'et Elohe Aram, ve'et Elohe Tzidon, ve'et Elohe Moab, ve'et Elohe Vnei Amon, ve'et Elohe Filishtim. That's a lot, right? That really means they're worshiping anybody, right? They're shooting in every direction here, right? They're worshiping every single idol that they can get their hands on. Vayazvu et Adonai v'lo avaduhu. They left God and they didn't worship him. Now, one of the things that we know about the book of Judges is that it's true that people keep sinning, but then there's that cycle, right? That cycle that we learned about when we were children. Am Yisrael sins, the nation of Israel sins, and God sends them a nation to punish them. And then they cry out to God, and God sends them a judge and says, well, he's going to save you, and he does. And then they sin again, right? But this cycle suggests that there's always this upward movement. And that may be true until this moment, because look at what's going to happen. God's going to punish them. Look in the next pasuk, in verse 7, in pasuk Zion, Vayichar af Adonai b'Yisrael. God becomes very angry at Israel. Vayim karem b'yad plishtim uviyad b'nei Amon. He sells them into the hands of these enemies. Look down in pasuk Yud, verse 10, for those of you who are following along in English. Here we have Am Yisrael crying out, right? They're having a hard time. Vayizaku b'nei Yisrael el Adonai le'mor, chatanu lach, v'chiyazavnu et Eloheinu, v'navod et abalim. Right? The requisite, we're sorry, we apologize, we did it, now give us our Savior. Right? That's the expectation. Look at what God says. Vayomer Adonai el b'nei Yisrael, halol mimitzrayim, umina emori, umin b'nei Amon, umin plishtim, v'tzidonim, v'amalek, u'ma'on lachatzu etchem, v'tizaku alai v'oshi etchem mi'adam. I saved you from a lot of people in the past. V'atem azevtem oti, and you kept forsaking me. V'tavdu Elohim acherim, and you worshipped idols. Lachin lo osif lo shi etchem. I'm done. I'm not going to save you anymore. L'chu v'za'aku el ha'elohim, Asher b'chartem bam. Heim yoshiu lachem be'etzaretchem. Right? There's a problem here with the cycle, and the cycle seems to go awry here, and the question really remains whether God answers their needs at any other point in the ensuing narratives. I'm not going to get into that for the moment, but I do want you to have a sense from this narrative of the religious decline that has taken place in the book. Here we have this description of their cumulative idolatry, and of course the book of Judges ends with the story of an idol. Micha makes for himself an idol. This is in chapter 17. It's one of the epilogue stories. That's why I say the story ends. The book ends with this story. Micha makes an idol, and he sets it up in a permanent idolatrous shrine, which he builds in Dan, which overshadows the Mishkan, which is in Shiloh. Nobody goes anymore to worship God in Shiloh. Nobody goes at any point in the book of Judges to worship God in Shiloh until the very last chapter. And when they go in the very last chapter, they have to be given specific directions how to get there. Now, Shiloh is not off the beaten path. Shiloh is right off of the major highway. And the fact that they need to have directions to get to Shiloh means they're not going to Shiloh anymore. Instead, they're going to idolatrous shrines. That is what has happened. That's the religious decline. More significant, I think, perhaps for our purposes, is the social deterioration which occurs in the book. The period of the judges is marked by increased tribalism, the unraveling of the national identity. This is conveyed in many different ways in the book of Judges. There is, on the one hand, an increasingly narrow sphere of military interest of the judge. What this means is that the judge is only really interested in his own tribe, right? Our first judge, Otniel, who is presumably a judge from the tribe of Judah, he goes and fights the Aramite nation all the way in the north, but he's the only one. After that, judges only fight in their very narrow geographical location. Not only that, but the judges, and this also is an indication of the social decline, the judges become less effective at rallying the people, at unifying the people. Think of Dvorah. This is maybe the most famous example. Dvorah, who calls the tribes, some of them come, many of them do not come. Yiftach also, Jephthah, he says to the people of Ephraim, I called you to war. Why didn't you come? right? There's a sense that people are only fighting for their own selves, for their own tribes. The Jewish nation is breaking off into tribal units. More significant than this, perhaps, are the social hostilities within the nation, which are recorded in the book. First, we have the story of Gideon, who is having all sorts of tensions with the tribe of Ephraim. Then we have the story of Gideon, who requests food for his troops from two Jewish cities in the Transjordanian area. They refuse to give food. And so on his way back from his war with the Midianites, he thrashes the people of one city and he kills the people of another city. The story of Yiftach takes us into a civil war. Right? Remember the Shibolet, Sibolet scene where Yiftach he whittles out the Ephraimites because they have some sort of speech or some sort of other dialect and they can't say a shin, and then he kills them all. That civil war between Menasha and Ephraim, okay, that's the two full brothers, the sons of Yosef, results in 42,000 people dead. This is all before the civil war, right? The social hostilities in the book also show us the social deterioration in the book. The collapse of the social order also means that there are not good, just everyday social interactions. As I said before, people don't give food to each other, right? Gideon asks a very reasonable request. He says, can I have some bread for my troops? I mean, they're fighting a war on behalf of the people of Israel. And they refuse. Hakaf zevach v'tzalmuna biadecha? Did you win the war that we should give you bread? No, maybe you should just give them bread because they are your brethren, right? But there is no sharing of food during this period of social collapse. It is a period in which we see thievery, we see highway ambush, we see brutal, vulgar, bullyish behavior. I can just mention the tribe of Dan, right? When they steal Micha's idol. Right, and Micha goes running after them and he says, give me back my idol. Right, it's a little bit of an amusing scene, except it actually goes in a very nasty direction. When the Bnei Dan turn to him and say to him, Al tashma kolcha imanu. You shouldn't really talk to us. Pen yifge'u vachem anashim marei nefesh. Because bitter people could hurt you. Right? It's a threat, and it's a very bullyish threat. And that's the way people are interacting on an everyday level during the period of the Shoftim. So the social decline is indicated both on a national level, that people don't rally together, that there's no sense of a unified nation, but it also occurs, it also is depicted in a interpersonal social interactions. The collapse of the social order reaches its rather terrible, stunning finale in the final story of the book. And that is, of course, the story of the concubine from Giv'ah. She's not from Giv'ah, but the concubine in Giv'ah and the ensuing civil war. This story, more than any other story, suggests, perhaps more than any other story in Tanakh, suggests a society that is no longer viable. A society that is on the brink of disaster, that is on the brink of self-implosion, which if that doesn't happen, God is sure to destroy them. And why is that? Because the story records a society where basic decency is absent, where there's no basic social kindness or positive interactions. In these last three chapters of the book of Judges, in a narrative which is strikingly reminiscent of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah back in the 19th chapter of Genesis? That was the story of a society which is not viable. That was the story of a society where God says, nothing good can come out of it. Let's overturn it and sow it with salt because nothing good can be born from there. That story is what happens at the end of the book of Judges. In fact, at the end of the book of Judges, we have a story of a man who is traveling with his concubine, And he arrives at a Benjamite city. This is not a city in the periphery. This is a city in the very heartland of Israel. The city that is part of the tribe of Nachalat HaMishkan, Nachalat HaShchinah. It is the place where God's presence dwells above it. And yet, look at the way that the people are behaving in the city. The travelers arrive in the city and nobody takes them in until one elderly man, reminiscent a little bit of Lot, right, who is a stranger to the town, offers them lodging. Now, their refuge in his house is rather short-lived because the Benjamite inhabitants of Gibeah soon surround the house of the host and demand to rape the traveler. The host says, oh, no, no, I couldn't possibly allow you to rape my guest. Here, you can have his concubine. And the man himself grabs his concubine, throws her to the men who rape her all night. It's a horrific narrative. I've actually, believe it or not, spared you most of the gory details of it. And the end of the story is a civil war, right, between Benjamin and the rest of the tribes. A civil war means the end of Am Yisrael. Right? If Benjamin is no longer in existence, if one tribe in Israel is wiped out of existence, then Israel is no longer. Israel is made up of all of these 12 tribes. And the story ends with a threat to the continuity of Benjamin, which means the continuity of the nation. This is the end of the book of Judges. It is a stone-like story, and as I said, it hovers over an abyss. There's this sense of imminent destruction. This is because Am Yisrael has become a society of violence and selfishness. It is not a viable or a healthy society. So to summarize what I've said so far, and this has really just been an attempt to sort of give an overview of the book of Judges, what I wanted to show is how the book spirals downward, almost out of control, in two different arenas. In the religious arena, what we would call Bein Adam LeMakom, between man and God, and in the social arena, what we would call Bein Adam LeChaveiro, between a man and his friend. Now, if we look at really the final five chapters of the book, which are an epilogue to the book, and we know that they're an epilogue to the book for one very clear reason, and that is there's no shofet in the final five chapters. There's no judge, right? What there is in these final five chapters are two separate stories. One is the story of the idolatrous shrine of Micha. That's the story of the collapse of religious order. And the second is the story of the concubine and the civil war, which is the collapse of the social order. Now, there is a refrain that goes throughout these five chapters and is common only to these five chapters, another unifying factor of these five chapters, and that refrain is, Bayamim ha'hem, ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'inav yaseh. In these days, there's no king of Israel, there's total anarchy. Everybody does whatever they want. What does it mean there's no king? There's no central unifying leadership. There's no one to rally everyone together. There's no one to unify the people, not for social purposes and not for religious purposes. The book ends on a low note, right? And this stone-like story ends with our sense, look at source number four, that Binyamin is on the verge of destruction. Look in source number four, in Judges 21, verse. Let's go to verse 17. Vayomru, here the Ziknei Ha'edah, the elders of the congregation, are concerned with the fact that the tribe of Benjamin seems to have been wiped out in the civil war. There are only 600 men left. Now, these 600 men have a problem. The problem is that during the course of the war, the tribes were so incensed at the behavior of the Benjamite tribe that they took an oath not to allow the Benjamite men to marry any of their women, right? So there's really no hope because these 600 men can't get married. And so the Ziknei Ha'edah realize they've made a terrible mistake. And what do they say? Yerushat Pleita LeBinyamin. We have to find some sort of inheritance so that Binyamin will survive. V'lo yimache shevet mi Yisrael, so that a tribe shall not be erased in Israel. Now, I want to say one final point about these last five chapters. I said that they represent both religious collapse and social collapse. I said that there is this refrain of there is no king in Israel at this time that runs throughout these five chapters. There's one other aspect or element in these chapters that indicates the absence of any sort of viable society in these five chapters, and that is the absence of names. Right? We have a large cast of anonymous characters in these final five chapters. We have a Levite, and we have his concubine, and we have her father, we have an elderly host, and we have the townspeople, and we have the elders of the congregation. We have lots and lots of people, but almost no names. This indicates that society is losing its identity. Names are elusive. The nation is slipping into oblivion. People don't see each other. This is, by the way, going to be the topic of our next lecture. We're going to talk a lot about names. Names are a very important theme in the book of Ruth. I'll just mention at one point, and that is the whole goal of Megillat Ruth is to establish the name of the dead upon his inheritance. Right, that's the goal of the Megillah. We're looking to get back our name. And I want to suggest that there's also a metaphoric meaning to this. Right, the loss of the name is an indication of, and also, I think, a factor in the collapse of society. Now, to fully understand what has happened and how we can fix the period of the judges, I think that we have to also look at what I believe is its primary cause, and that is, I think, really begins and ends with the problem of leadership. I think we also have to understand, I mentioned that the story comes right after Yahushua, but right before monarchy. And it's a story that is betwixt and between in terms of leadership. The book opens with the death of Joshua. Now, Joshua was the leader who inherited the mantle of Moshe, and he is appointed in Moshe's lifetime. In the 27th chapter of the book of Numbers, he is appointed to succeed Moshe after Moshe's death, but he's appointed when Moshe is still alive. Yahushua doesn't do that. Yahushua doesn't appoint a leader. And so we open the book of Shoftim with a leadership quandary and a leadership question. And if you look here in source number 7, these are the opening psukim, the opening verses of the book of Judges. Vahi acharei mot Yoshua, vayishalu bnei Israel ba'adonai leimor, mi ale lanu el haknani batichila lihilachem bo. Which, paraphrased, really means, who will lead us now? Specifically into battle. But who's going to lead us? Yoshua's gone. Who's going to be our next leader? And we really have two questions here. One is, why doesn't Yahushua appoint a leader? And the second question is, there's a certain curiosity in God's answer, in God's reply. Vayomer Adonai Yehudaya ale, hine natati et haaretz biado. What's problematic here? He doesn't name a person. Just in the same way he says, Yehudaya ale, he could have pointed at Otniel ben Kenaz and said, him, Otniel ben Kenaz, he's going to be your first leader. I think that the point and the answer to both of these questions is the same, which is that there isn't one specific leader that we're looking for now. We are now looking to set up the monarchy. Don't forget, and look in source number 5, that we are told specifically that there are 3 mitzvot that we are meant to do after we conquer the land of Israel. The first one, limanot lahem melech. We have to set up a monarchy. For all the controversy and reservations that we have with regard to the monarchy, which appear also in the Tanakh and also in later sources, the book ends by explaining to us repeatedly that the absence of monarchy is the reason for the chaos. It is the reason for the murder and the mayhem and the civil war, which occurs at the end of the book of Judges. That's the final verse of the book. Bayamim haheim ein melech b'Yisrael ish hayashar be'inav yaseh. You didn't listen to God in the beginning. In the beginning, God said, Yehudaya aleh, you were supposed to set up a monarchy. And look at what all of this has come to. This is, I think, the primary reason for the decline in the book of Judges. I don't actually have a real explanation why Yehuda does not get up and act as monarchs. It seems to be simply a failure. Not only is there no monarchy that is set up in the book of Judges, there's also no tribe of Yehuda. They sort of disappear. Even Otniel, right? It was Otniel ben Kenaz, who we assume is from the tribe of Yehuda, actually never says about him that he's from the tribe of Yehuda. We just assume that because he has the connection with Kenaz and with Kalev, right? And actually Rashi actually contradicts himself. In one place he says that Otniel is from Yehuda. In another place he says that he's from Levi, right? He's from the tribe of Levi. In any case, though, one other interesting thing to note is that when Devorah, in her Shira, makes a list of the tribes who come and the tribes who don't come, right? Where's Yehuda on the list? Nowhere. Nowhere. She doesn't even call them. Right? They're not even given an opportunity to come because they are so not functioning during the period of the judges. And this, in my mind, is the first failure. The leadership failure is what leads to all of the decline. And that's what the text tells us at the very end. If there was a king, we would never have gotten here. Oh, we might have gotten to other bad places, right? I'm not saying that the kingship is an automatic solution, but without the kingship, we are left with those final five chapters in the book of Judges. Actually, one other interesting point, if you look here at the map that I gave you, oh, it came out a little bit too small. Okay, so don't look at the map right now. But I'll just mention that one of the things that we see is that as the judges progress in the book of Judges, I think that there's a certain decline among the religious integrity of the judges themselves. I'm not going to get into that right now. But as we move through the book, we see a decline, and also a decline in terms of their effectiveness, in terms of their leadership capabilities. There's a certain decline, right, until we get to Shimshon, who really doesn't lead anybody at all. As the decline happens, we actually see that there's a geographical movement away from Judah. Okay, the first tribe, the first judge after Otniel is Ehud from Binyamin. We then have Devorah, who sits in Har Ephraim. We then have Gideon from Menashe. We then have Yiftach from Gilad. You see it? They're moving away from Judah. And as they get farther and farther from Judah, the dream of monarchy and of strong, centralized, dynastic leadership, which can create stability and unity and perhaps even rally the people to build the Beit HaMikdash and to serve God, all of that dissipates. Okay, so I brought for you also this graphic, which is maybe to sum up what I've said about Sefer Shoftim. The graphic here is on page 4. I'll thank my son for doing the graphic because I have no idea how to do things like this. But here at the top, I put failed leadership. And on the right side, I showed how that leads to religious deterioration, which is chapter 17 and 18. On the left side, I showed it leads also to social deterioration. And these are the final five chapters of the book. Now, all of this leads us back to Megillat Rut, and that's really what I want to talk about now. Megillat Rut, of course, is the opposite of the book of Judges, and therefore, it is its solution. We begin, or we don't begin with this, but we end with a leader from the tribe of Yehuda, a leader from Beit Lechem. His name is Boaz. We have acts of kindness, which correct the deficient social situation. The book is filled with mitzvot. The book is filled with mentions of God, which seems to correct the religious predicament. Now, one conclusion that we can already draw is that Megillat Rut cannot be part of the book of Judges because it is such a different book. It goes in such a different direction. Judges is a book which portrays a society that is not viable, a society that progressively deteriorates until its final verse. There is no king in Israel, therefore chaos. Rut is a book which depicts an idyllic set of human dealings, which moves in an increasingly positive direction until its final verse, which is Vishai Holid et David. The last word of the book of Rut is David. The goal of the book of Rut is to establish a monarchy. It takes us in exactly the opposite direction. The book of Ruth lifts us out of the dark period of the book of Judges, which of course ended with that looming existential threat. And yet, as I assume some of you are thinking this, it's not really as simple as that, right? If we examine the book carefully, what we see is that the book of Ruth is actually filled with Shoftim-like characters, with judges-like personalities. Think about the women of Bethlehem, who come out to greet Naomi after not having seen her for over 10 years, right? And what do they say? Hazot Naomi, is this Naomi? Now, the Gemara, of course, has them jeering at her, right? Oh, is that Naomi who left us when she was dressed to the nines? And look at her now, without a husband, without sons, without means. And that's the Gemara's reading. We don't really know what the tone of those words actually was. But what we do know is that these women do not embrace Naomi. More importantly, they do not bring her food. They don't even bring her minimal food for survival. And they totally ignore Ruth. Nobody even mentions Ruth. And one of the striking things that occurs in that initial scene when Naomi and Ruth come back to Beit Lechem is that Naomi has this long conversation with the women and nobody mentions Ruth. Where's Ruth? Well, she's standing at the side. Nobody's interested in Ruth. And I would say even something perhaps more extreme. Were it not for Ruth volunteering to go and get food from the field, Naomi and Ruth would have starved to death. Okay, there's nobody bringing them food. That's a Shoftim-like scenario. Think of this point. When Boaz decides, it meets Ruth in the field, and he's very nice to her, one of the things that he tells her that he did for her was, he says, "Halo tziviti et ha-ne'arim levilti nogeich. I have commanded the boys, the reapers in the field, not to touch you." Which leads us to the conclusion that had he not commanded, they would have regarded her, like the men in Giv'ah, as a sexual object. Right? That's what the pasuk itself indicates. Think of the Goel, Ploni Almoni, Mr. No Name, right? That's his name. His name is No Name. At the end of the book, a man also from the tribe of Yehudah, a leadership tribe, the closest living relative of Naomi's husband, who is very, very excited and jumps at the opportunity to buy Elimelech's field. It's going to make him very rich, but he panics at the thought of marrying Ruth, even though he is told that the purpose is to establish the name of the dead. He panics. He displays no leadership, no kindness, no desire to help the other. These are Shoftim-like figures, people who don't give food, people from leadership tribes who do not act as leaders, people who treat others as sexual objects. I think, in fact, that the other place where we see the background of Megillat Ruth is really Sefer Shoftim, and really what I'm trying to show you is that the book of Ruth is deeply placed in the period of the Shoftim. There are events that occur there that turn around the trajectory of the period, but the period is there. It's in the background, and I think one of the first places that we see it is in the very first verses of the book. Think about the way that the book of Ruth begins. Let's look at those first two verses. Vayhi bimei shvot ha-shoftim. Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz. There's a famine in the land. Vayelech ish mi beit lechem Yehuda lagor bistei Moav. Hu v'ishto ushnei vanav. There's a famine in the land, and a man goes from Beit Lechem Yehuda to live in the fields of Moab, he, his wife, and his two sons. Now, on one level, this seems very neutral. We know that Chazal, they really malign the characters here, and I'm trying to give you a sense of why they do this. I think we're going to understand better the different Midrashim, which really malign Elimelech for having left the people during the time of the famine. The pasuk itself doesn't indicate that there's anything wrong, but look at what they do. There's a time of a famine. They leave. Not only do they leave, and think about it, they're from the tribe of Yehudah. They're from a leadership tribe. Not only do they leave, but they go to Moab, right? And what is Moab? Moab is two things I want to say about Moab, and we're going to have occasion to talk about this in other lectures in this series as well. Moab is, first of all, the spiritual heir of Sodom and Amorah, right? It comes out of Sodom and Amorah. Lot and his daughters have this incestuous relationship and bring about Moab and Ammon, but they're also the actual continuation of Sodom and Gomorrah. What do we know about Moab and Ammon? They are a place which Asher lo kidmu etchem belechem uvemayim bederech b'seitchem imitzrayim. They didn't give you bread. They didn't give you water. This is a place where there is no viable social infrastructure, where people are not giving food to the other. That's Moab. That's Sodom and Gomorrah. And also the fact, of course, that Moab and Ammon are born to an incestuous relationship. Okay. Now, when the tribe of Yehudah goes to Moab, it tells us two things. First of all, it tells us they have plenty of food to survive. They're not going to Moab in order to get food because nobody there is going to give them food. It also tells us they go to Moab because they identify with Moab. This is what Judeans are doing during the period of the Shoftim. Before I said there was a failure of the tribe of Yehudah during the period of the Shoftim. And I said, I don't know why. I can't explain it. I think the beginning of Megillat Rut might be trying to explain to us, where is the tribe of Yehudah? During the period of the judges, they're off in Moab. They're worrying about themselves. They have plenty of food, and they identify with this stingy, miserly culture that doesn't offer food to each other, and so they go there. I want to offer another idea, which is that this is a metaphoric reading as well. When the when these characters go to Moab, this is mirrors the whole trajectory of the book of Judges, in which where do we find Am Yisrael at the end of the book of Judges? They're in Sodom. They're in Moab. Because we want to understand, how did Am Yisrael get to Sodom by the end of the book of Judges? And I suggested, I think it's a leadership problem. Look where their leaders are going. Their leaders are going to Moab. This, in my mind, is the reason that Chazal famously deal so harshly with Elimelech's decision to leave, and they even construct this rather fanciful midrash to explain why we should be angry at them. Okay, I want you to see this midrash inside, because I think the midrash really coheres with a lot of what I've been trying to explain here. Look in source number 9. This is a very well-known midrash because Rashi brings it, right? So we know the midrashim that Rashi brings. The midrash tells us as follows. Kach Elimelech haya migdolei hamedina umifarnasei hador. Right, the first thing the midrash says is Elimelech, you might not know this, he was one of the great leaders, and he was the one who had responsibility for providing sustenance for the other. It's completely made up, right? In other words, we have no indication of that. But Chazal are trying to explain to us, I think, where the leaders went during the period of the judges. And look what they say. Ukshebau shnei ra'avon. When the years of famine came, Amar, he said to himself, Elimelech, Achshav kol Yisrael mesavavim pitchi. Ze bekupato. He said, oh no. Everybody's going to surround my house with their tzedakah boxes. I don't want to give tzedakah to everybody. He doesn't say I don't have it. He says, I don't want to do it. Amad ubarachlo mipnehem. He got up and he ran away from them. This midrash is not the pshat. It is a fanciful midrash that is, I think, an attempt to describe these men as shoftim-like people. They do three things here, right? First of all, they don't give food. Secondly, they don't act as leaders. And thirdly, think of the actual scenario that is built here. They surround the house, right? Or think it reminds us a little bit of Sodom and Gomorrah, a little bit of Am Yisrael at the end. In this case, the good guys are the ones outside, and the bad ones are the ones inside. But the actual construction of the scenario is it evokes Sodom-like images. Now, the punishment of Elimelech, Machlon, and Chilion is exactly the punishment of the people during the period of the judges, right? What we have here is a family which is threatened with erasure, which is threatened with no more continuity, with the end of the family line and the end of the family name. This is what we said about the end of Judges, right? It is about threatening the nation with the end of their names, with the end of their national identity, right? Elimelech's family is threatened, I think, in the same way as the people in the time of the judges, to show us that it's the same story. The two stories, the story of the threat to the family line of Naomi, is the story of the threat to the nation of Israel that exists during the time of the judges. And I want to offer perhaps one other interesting midrashic proof of this reading, or not proof, but something that perhaps supports this reading in the midrash. Look in source number 10. The Midrash very much likes to explain names, likes to give name etymologies, which offer more than just an explanation of the name, but some sort of explanation of the essence of the person. And look at the explanation of the names of the sons of Elimelech. V'shem shnei vanav, Machlon v'chilion, Machlon shenimchu min haolam, v'chilion shekalu min haolam. Okay, they're called Machlon because they were erased from the world. They're called Kilion because they were destroyed from the world. So this Midrash suggests on one level that the very names of the sons actually are filled with the impending disaster of their erasure. But there's actually something very odd about the etymology of the name Machlon, because they drop the Lamed, right? Kilion's a good etymology. Machlon, they drop the Lamed. If you want to find a negative etymology for the name Machlon, by the way, there are lots of good positive ones. It could be Machol, it could be Mechila, it could be Nachala, right? I'm sure his mother didn't name him that because she wanted him to be erased, right? But certainly if I'm looking for a bad etymology for the name Machlon, I could come up with Machala, right? That's a better one. But why does it say Nimchu min haolam? Remember back in source number 2, or maybe it was source number 4, we saw at the end of the book of Judges, the threat was v'lo yimacheh shevet miYisrael, a tribe that can be erased from Israel. That's what I think Chazal are saying about this family. This family embodies the national threat at this time. And this is the theory that I want to propose that will accompany us throughout our learning of Megillat Rut. I want to suggest that this book exists on two levels, the micro and the macro, the personal and the national, the surface and the deep. It's not just about one family. It's about the nation of Israel. On one level, it's about one family. It's about how we resolve the problem of the catastrophe, the disaster that has befallen Elimelech's family. But really, it should be understood as a narrative which is seeking to find the solution for the national predicament during the period of the judges. I'm going to elaborate on this for a few minutes. We're going to talk about this a lot. Every single point that we're going to look for in Megillat Rut, we're going to look for it on both of these levels. On the surface, Megillat Rut is about the loss of continuity for this one family. What it primarily is about is the threatened loss of continuity of the nation of Israel. On the surface, Megillat Rut is about the quest for the birth of a child to extricate Naomi from her predicament. But on a deeper level, it is about a quest for the birth of a king to extricate society from its predicament. On the surface, Megillat Rut is about the family's need for a name, need for identity, destiny, belonging, a genealogy. But on a deeper level, it is about the nation's need for a name. On the surface, this story is about the family's need to preserve their nachala, their inheritance. But what actually lingers in the background is whether the nation will continue to have the rights to their land and their nachala during this delicate period of the judges. On the surface, and this we're going to talk about in our second class, Megillat Rut is about the need to acquire recognition for Rut, a foreigner amongst the people of Bethlehem. On a deeper level, this story is really about getting the people to stop relating to each other as objects, but rather to see people, to see subjects. And this, of course, is the story of the concubine. On the surface, Megillat Rut may be about how this family returns from Moab and attempts to reintegrate into Beit Lechem. but it is actually about how the nation returns from Moab, returns from having themselves become Moab-like, having adopted the character traits of Moab and the Sodom and of Amorah-like behavior, which is displayed at the end of the book of Judges. So how does it do this? Right? This is really what it does. Megillat Rut operates on two levels, a personal level and a national level. How does it do this? How does it fix its own problems as well as the problems of the period of the judges, especially in light of what I've just said, which is that the people in the book of Rut are just like everybody else during the period of the judges. And the Judean leaders in the book of Rut have themselves absconded with their family during this time of need and gone to join a society which is a society of selfishness and stinginess. And the answer is very simple. The answer lies in the two outstanding characters which are featured in the book of Rut, and who lead to the Malchut directly. And of course, here we're talking about Boaz and Rut. Both Boaz and Rut are presented as anti-judges-like characters, okay? The book of Judges may cast a spotlight upon failed leadership, particularly the failed leadership of Yehudah, of Judah, who fails to arise and set up a monarchy. The book of Rut casts a spotlight upon successful leadership. Failed leadership in the book of Judges, successful leadership in the book of Rut. We see it all over the place. I'll just mention one example that came up this morning in one of the shiurim that I was teaching this morning, and that is in the story of Devorah and Barak, right? When Barak goes off to war, or when Devorah comes to Barak to ask him to go off to war, she actually commands him in the name of God. She is herself a Nevi'ah, right? She is a prophetess. And she says, she uses the word Tziva. She says, Halo Tziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael. And then she promises him divine victory. Unetatihu biyadecha, she says, right? And then he says, well, im telchi mi v'halachti, vim lo telchi mi lo elech, right? He says, maybe I'll go. If you go with me, I'll go. But if not, definitely not. I'm not going. Right? What does that remind us of? Think of Rut in her unexpected oath of loyalty. It's completely unanticipated. Basher telchi eleich, uvasher talini alin, amech ami, v'elohayich elohai, basher tamuti amut, v'sham akaver. Here we have an oath of absolutely unconditional loyalty. That's Rut. Rut, her character is the opposite of the character in the time of the Shoftim. And Rut, of course, role models, and we'll talk about this in the third shiur, leaving her Moabite background and making a choice to leave it behind and go to Beit Lechem. So this is part of the solution. We're going to talk a lot about how Boaz and Rut bring about the solution to the period of the judges. We're going to see the details primarily in the next two classes. Chapter 2 is all about giving food. Right? That's what we said wasn't happening in the book of Judges. Chapter 2 is all about giving food. Everybody's giving food to each other. Well, primarily Boaz and Rut, right, are giving food. Chapter 3 is about seeing people as subjects rather than objects. Okay? We're going to talk about that also. I think one of the outstanding, perhaps, messages that emerges from this book is the fact that the entire reversal of the downward spiral of society is actually accomplished by two individuals, which spirals outward to national renewal. I think it's a very powerful thing. Right? We're talking about an entire society that is spiraling downwards in an astonishing way, and these two individuals come and actually turn around the entire period. So what I want to conclude and say, and I'm going to spend a couple more minutes on my final literary point, but for now I want to conclude and say that really I think the book of Rut is a contrast to the book of Judges, and perhaps more importantly, it is a tikkun for the book of Judges. It teaches us how to remove ourselves from the period of the judges and to move now in a positive direction that actually enables us to get to that next period of setting up the monarchy. And lest you misunderstand me, I'm not suggesting that the monarchy is an automatically positive solution. There are a lot of problems during the period of the monarchy, but for the present, it's the only solution, and the only way to get there is through Rut and Boaz. The last point that I want to make in tonight's shiur is a literary point. And this is a strikingly successful literary book. This has been called, even by professors of literature, the master short story. And it is. And we'll talk about that a lot in our final class. It's a master short story. And that, I think, very much is one of the things that characterizes the book. The Book of Ruth has a what I want to show you right now is that the Book of Ruth has a profusion of literary parallels to the final horrific story of the concubine and the ensuing civil war. It's really, I think, astonishing how many literary parallels there are. And what this illustrates, and what it tries to illustrate, the minute you start comparing, is what a different direction this book takes when it has almost the very same material that it's working with, right? And we're working with the same words, the same semantic field we have in the Book of Ruth that we had in the story of the rape of the concubine in Giv'ah. And the Book of Ruth mirrors that story, converses with that story, and ultimately repairs that story and the attending social collapse, which is represented in that final terrible story in the book. So what I want to do now to conclude our shiur is to engage in a short literary exercise of examining the linguistic parallels between these two narratives. I've tried to make it a little bit easier by bolding the words that parallel, and I'm going to give a bit of a short synopsis. We're going to first look at chart 11. I'm going to give a short synopsis as we go through this chart. We begin with a husband. This is the Levite traveling to retrieve his concubine and speak to her heart. Look here in the right-hand column in what I called here zero. Vayakom isha vayelech acharea lidaber al liba. You see, there are no names here. That's the book of Judges. This man goes to speak to her heart. Now, when he gets there, he pays her almost no attention, and he seems mostly oblivious to her presence. Instead, look in source number one, he's eating and drinking a lot, okay? Three different times we're told he's eating, he's drinking. Who's he eating and drinking with? Not with his concubine, with her father. She's somewhere in the background. He never seems to speak to her. He doesn't even speak about her. He certainly doesn't invite her to eat with him, okay? The eating is important because we said it's all about giving food. When the man and his concubine finally go on their way, they arrive in Giv'ah, look at number six. Vayasuru sham lavo lalun. They go there to lodge for the night. Ve'ein ish ma'asef otam habayta lalun. Right? No one gives them lodgings. Finally, as we said before, one man offers them hospitality. Now, this man, this elderly man, he says, well, why are you here in the street? And the Levite, the husband of the concubine, explains, Ein ish ma'asef oti habayta. He only talks about himself. Right? He says, I'm here, nobody's helping me. He doesn't ever mention his concubine. Now, once he gets into the house, amid the extensive description of his own feasting, at no point does he give any food to his concubine. She is not part of the feasting. Throughout the story, no one ever gives her food. Now, she also never speaks. No one ever really speaks about her. On some level, she's the focus of the story, right? But of course, she is not. She is very much the object in the story. And even her husband objectifies her, and her father, and the nice host, right? Everybody regards her as an object. It's not very surprising, therefore, that when the husband himself is threatened with rape, he prefers to forfeit his concubine, and instead of protecting her, he throws her into the street. Look in source number eight, right? The people demand, Hotzea ta'isha sher ba'al beitcha v'neda'enu, and instead, vayedu ota. Look at the word vayedu ota. They know her, of course, in a sexual sense, right? Vayitalu va kol halayla ad haboker. They torture her, they torment her all night until the morning. Now, I made a very serious error in this chart in source number four, and I want to point it out to you. They should be reversed, right? Oh, no, someone changed it. If Alex did that, I thank you, Alex, because in my chart, I have them reversed for some reason. You did it. Okay, great. Thank you. That's terrific. Okay, so look at what happens here in source number four. After this terrible night, morning comes. Look at the word boker three times. Boker, 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 three times in rapid succession, and in the morning, the woman is lying, fallen on the threshold, as her master arises. Okay, look in pasuk in number five. Vatipol, she is fallen. Look at number three. Vatipol petach beit aish asher adoneha sham. Her master is there. Vayakom adoneha baboker. Her master gets up in the morning. Right, the master rises in the morning. He forgot about her. He's on his way, and suddenly he notices she is sprawled on the threshold, and he speaks to her. Ve'ein kol ve'ein oneh. She does not respond. Having failed to elicit a response, the man puts her on his donkey, takes her home, and look in source number nine, va'ochez b'filagshi v'anatcheha. I grabbed hold of my concubine and dismembered her. I told you I left out a lot of the gory details, so I'm sorry. Here we have some of those gory details. He then sends the different parts of his concubine around the country. She becomes, the mail, right? I mean, she becomes the message that he sends to them. And this is a terrible description of alienation and violence, of the objectification of the other. No one has a name. The Pilegesh doesn't have a name. She's basically an object. Now, what I want you to see, and this is, I think, what's really extraordinary, is that the contrasting narrative in Megillat Rut uses so much language of this story that it evokes that horrific story over and over and over, even though it tells a story of tranquility, of warmth, of kindness, of recognition of the other. Boaz recognizes Rut. He gives her food over and over. In chapter 2, in chapter 3, she states with great sincerity in number 0 that he has spoken to her heart. Ki nichamtani v'chi dibarta alev shifratecha. He spoke to her heart because he gave her food, right? The husband never could speak to his concubine's heart because he never gives her anything. He never regards her needs. And then, look at number 5, she falls on her face in gratitude before him. Okay, this is, of course, of her own initiative. She's not sprawled helplessly on the threshold of the house because of what others have done to her. She falls on her face deliberately. She calls him her master in source number 3. Emsachin be'enecha Adoni, I have found favor in your eyes, my master. In chapter 3, Boaz encounters Ruth at night when she stealthily approaches him in a rather suggestive manner, to say the least. Instead of allowing himself to advance, to make some sort of sexual advance, and in contrast, of course, to the terrible night of the concubine's torture and objectification, Boaz's response when she approaches him in the night is gentle and noble. He blesses Rut in the name of God. Bruchat la Shem biti hetaft chastecha acharon min arishon. He talks about her kindness. He calls her an eshet chayil. And then he offers her safe lodgings for the night. Look at number 6. Lini halayla, he says to her. Maintaining that in the morning, and look at that in number 4. Boker, three times in rapid succession. Baboker, baboker, baboker. He promises that he will ensure her marriage. Mindful of her reputation, she rises early in the morning. Look in source number 7. Vatakom beterem yakir ishet re'ehu. Lest someone misinterpret what occurred in the night in the threshing floor. And in fact, at Boaz's urging, Rut departs before the light of day, so that, look in number 8. Al yivada ki va'a ha'isha ha'goren. It should not be known, right? That same word that was used for sexual violence in the story of the concubine here is used in order to promise Rut that no one will find out and she won't endanger her reputation. Now, finally, and I think this is also a very powerful parallel, right before Boaz departs, right before Rut departs the field, Boaz entreats her to bring forth her kerchief and grab hold of it so that she can place food in it. Look at number 9 here. Okay, Vayomer havi hamitpachat asher laich ve'echoziva v'tochezba. Right, the same violent word that was used when the man seized his concubine in order to dismember her is here used when Boaz says to Rut, "Why don't you hold your handkerchief and then I can put in it food?" Okay, now the next chart. I'm not going to go through it with you just for lack of time. You'll see on your own what it is that I was trying to do here. The results of the story are contrasted one with the other, as opposed to the story of the concubine, which ends with a terrible civil war, catastrophic fighting between brothers. This story leads to marriage. It leads to union between brothers. And of course, while the tribe of Benjamin at the end of the story is threatened with extermination, and as I mentioned before, the nation swears, takes an oath accompanied by a curse, not to intermarry with the tribe of Benjamin, which leaves the tribe of Benjamin hanging over the abyss of certain destruction. This is framed as an oath. Arur notain bi isha levinyamin. Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Binyamin. The book ends with a curse. It ends with a threat. And that's why the threat of destruction is still looming. Whereas the end of Megillat Rut, the fear of erasure is taken care of. There, the marriage takes place. They have established the name upon the deceased man's inheritance. Marriage is procured in a tranquil and sympathetic environment. And of course, Megillat Rut ends not with a curse, but with an abundance of blessings in all directions. Right? Baruch Hu Hashem Asher Lo Azav Chasto Et HaChayim Ve'et HaMetim. That's the blessing for Boaz, and Brucha At LaHashem Biti Hatav Chastecha Acharon Min HaRishon. That's the blessing of Rut. And of course, there's the blessing of God. Baruch Hashem Asher Lo Hishpit Lach Goel Hayom. Right? There's a blessing also of God. And so Rut ends with an abundance of blessings, with hopeful prospects for society's well-being. Megillat Rut provides an alternative and a solution for the period of the judges. In solving the predicament of Elimelech's family, the Book of Rut actually seeks the broader solution for the period of the judges. That's the national significance of the book. Boaz and Rut's acts of loyalty and generosity, their ability to recognize the needs of the other, to treat people with dignity and respect, creates a social environment which allows the book to thrive and to create a society which thrives and which can attain continuity and stability. Boaz and Rut personally change the trajectory of this period, guiding the nation to stability. And that is, of course, the conclusion of the book, where in the final analysis, the birth of David, or the birth of Oved, which leads to the birth of David, which is, of course, the solution for the family of Elimelech and Naomi, is also the triumphant conclusion and solution for the book of Judges. The book of Judges, which ended Ein Melech b'Yisrael, has now been corrected by the book of Rut, which leads us to Bayamim Ahem, Yesh Melech b'Yisrael, V'Yishai Holid et David. Thank you.